c'est Jean-Marc Manac, je suis membre de la FIM, la Fondation Internet Nouvelle Génération, donc on est très content de vous accueillir ce soir, je suis très bien. Il y a quelques temps de ça, on avait fait au niveau de la FIM un groupe de travail qui s'appelait Musique et Internet, au moment où il y avait un projet de loi qui s'appelait la DVRDVSI. Tout le monde était un petit peu en train de s'écharper, et nous on avait fait, la FIM, on avait fait le pari d'essayer de voir en quelle mesure des personnes qui avaient des positions irréconciliables pouvaient discuter, se retrouver ensemble pour discuter un petit peu autour d'un thème qui était musique et internet. Donc on avait réussi un petit peu à ce que le débat essaye d'avancer, que les gens essayent de trouver comment s'en sortir un petit peu par le haut et sortir des conflits, des guerres qu'il y avait en permanence. Aujourd'hui, il y a un projet de loi qui s'appelle Création Internet. Donc c'est reparti, on est reparti avec les mêmes problèmes qui avaient été posés par la DAFSI, voire pire. Pour certains, et on est très content d'avoir Moglen, parce que le point de vue qu'il a par rapport à cet environnement-là de la création et Internet est quelque chose qui évite un petit peu les ornières et qui revient à des principes de base qui est la liberté, le citoyen dans ce que c'est qu'Internet. Donc je vais laisser Philippe Aigrin présenter un petit peu le parcours et la personne.
Bonsoir, donc, je suis Philippe Aigrin, un des animateurs de la Quadrature du Net. La Quadrature du Net, c'est un petit collectif citoyen qui s'est fondé, disons, l'événement déclencheur, ça a été le dépôt, la préparation ou les rumeurs d'un certain nombre de textes législatifs, mais notre ambition est que vous allez le voir plus profond. Alors, il est vrai que nous étions très inquiets des dispositions prévues dans ces différents textes que nous considérons comme dangereuses pour les libertés, pour le fonctionnement normal de la séparation des pouvoirs, pour même le développement d'un certain nombre d'activités. Il est vrai aussi que nous avons été indignés des modes de préparation de la législation depuis très longtemps et de la très mauvaise gouvernance démocratique de ces préparations. Mais toutes ces réactions négatives, en fait, ne sont rien à côté du sentiment d'une occasion perdue qui est celle de débattre plus au fond du futur que nous voulons pour nos sociétés et du rôle que tiennent les échanges informationnels dans ce futur et du nouveau paysage qui trace pour la culture. Et cela nous conduit en particulier à voir des débats législatifs ou des débats réglementaires où les options qui sont envisagées sont complètement tronquées, où seul un petit ensemble d'options est envisagé, mais surtout où on perd de vue les perspectives. Et dans cet esprit, nous sommes particulièrement heureux de pouvoir donner la parole à Evan Moglen. Alors Evan Moglen est professeur de droit et d'histoire du droit à l'Université Columbia. Il est connu depuis longtemps pour avoir été d'abord le conseil de la Fondation du logiciel libre, la FSF, puis avoir fondé et dirigé un organisme, une fondation à but non lucratif qui travaille à l'environnement juridique des projets du logiciel libre qui s'appelle le Software Freedom Law Center. Mais en dehors de cet univers du logiciel libre, Eben est aussi un penseur de fond sur les enjeux de ce qu'on appelait il y a quelques années la société de l'information, et maintenant dans certains cercles on n'en parle même plus. Il propose une combinaison qui est extrêmement rare, qui est une pensée radicale et en même temps une activité qui est celle d'un ingénieur de consensus et de compromis. Il y a ceux qui ont suivi le processus de révision de la licence libre GPL ont pu témoigner de ce qu'on avait une espèce d'expérience de gouvernance à l'échelle planétaire d'un processus où les acteurs étaient extrêmement dissymétriques. C'était à la fois Intel, IBM et un développeur isolé en Croatie ou au Brésil. Et malgré ça, on a pu avoir quelque chose qui, dans son propre champ, est un modèle. Alors, Eber est un penseur radical, et ce soir, c'est à lui que nous allons donner la parole, c'est à cette casquette. Mais rappelez-vous que radical, ça veut dire, comme Jean-Marc l'a dit, revenir à la racine des choses, et c'est ce que je crois Eben va faire.
Mesdames et messieurs, je me sens très honoré d'être ici ce soir. Je remercie les organisateurs, particulièrement Philippe Grain. Plusieurs escarmouches ont eu lieu autour des industries culturelles depuis 10 ans, mais une bataille plus décisive s'est déclenchée ici et maintenant. Les soi-disant propriétaires de la culture ont essayé plusieurs stratégies dans le passé pour empêcher les transformations des échanges culturels. Ainsi, par exemple, 37 personnes ont été poursuivies aux États-Unis pour partage. 37 000 personnes ont été poursuivies aux États-Unis pour partage des fichiers musicaux par les groupes d'intérêt représentant les majors musicales. 77 millions de dollars ont ainsi été gagnés par ces industriels, dont ils n'ont pas versé un centime aux musiciens. Comme nous l'avons prévu, ces actions coercitives n'ont en rien empêché la reprise en main de la distribution culturelle par les jeunes du monde. À côté des actions juridiques, les propriétaires ont aussi essayé de contrôler les technologies de traitement de l'information en y installant des DRM, abusivement appelés systèmes de gestion des droits numériques, alors qu'il ne s'agit que des systèmes de contrôle des actions des usagers. Mais ces efforts ont aussi été sans effet. À vrai dire, l'utilisation des DRM est peut-être plus dangereuse pour l'industrie musicale et technologique que les actions des enfants protégeurs. Comme les efforts de contrôler directement les comportements du public et les technologies de reproduction étaient aussi inefficaces l'un que l'autre, comme les industries propriétaires ne pouvaient pas risquer d'être encore plus détestées par le client, ils mettent maintenant une nouvelle stratégie. Elle consiste à forcer les opérateurs de réseau et l'État à agir à leur place. Il arrive en Europe, équipé de métaphores du baseball, la three-strike approach. Baptisé ici, je crois, riposte graduée, mais dans le sens au baseball est, je vous le rappelle, 3 coups et je vous mets dehors. Cette métaphore, au-delà de son origine américaine, est fondée sur une hypothèse, l'idée qu'il existerait un dehors. Mais tous ceux qui voient plus loin que le besoin de soulager les souffrances d'un business particulier sont conscients des efforts et des investissements que nous avons consacrés pour développer une infrastructure informationnelle qui ne laisse personne dehors. Mettons-nous donc d'accord sur le fait que de décider que quelqu'un se replace dehors, exclu de l'Internet, est en contradiction un sur l'autre avec les objectifs de pouvoir public du XXIe siècle. Au lieu de nous préparer à exclure une génération du net parce qu'elle croit au partage, notre intention doit être d'encourager et de construire les technologies et le comportement social qui rendent le partage inévitable. Je m'attends donc à entendre bientôt parler d'un riposte graduée sans conclusion. 3 strikes, mais pas encore. Sous prétexte de l'absence de sanctions formelles, on prétendra qu'il est acceptable que des personnes soient accusées de violation ou même d'être des pirates sans même avoir la possibilité de répondre. Non seulement le débouche du processus du riposte gradué est inacceptable, mais son déroulement ne vaut pas mieux, que ce soit pour le fournisseur d'accès ou pour l'autre autorité dont la mise en place est prévue, en étant en pleine confusion des rôles. L'alternative serait, nous dit-on, d'affirmer les artistes sans rémunération et de provoquer l'effondrement de nos civilisations. Heureusement, ce n'est pas ainsi que les choses fonctionnent. How do they actually work? So let me try and indicate how they actually work now. All over the world, question of what to do after sharing becomes inevitable is already fully in agitation. The attempt to control music, which began at the end of the 1990s, is really, despite this last rearguard action, inevitable and given up. Controlling music failed because music files were comparatively small, because music files were easily shared, because the thirst for music, the hunger for a sound which belongs to me, which is the soundtrack of my life, had been developed by the technology of the Walkman for a generation by the time the actual digital revolution arrived and it became possible for people to program their own radio station in their head for a lifetime. In other words, the population that came to the digital revolution had pre-developed a taste for the sharing and freeing of music. And once the means were available in their hands, under their control, once the plasticity of music as bits had become fully realized, all attempts to control sharing were nothing more than an attempt to lock the barn after the departure of the horse. Nonetheless, the recording companies of the world made every single mistake it was possible to make, and they continued to make them. The first crisis of design was the crisis of the assumption, which I referred to in my opening remarks, that the technology of music itself could be rendered controllable through digital rights management and the prohibition on machines that do what you want. The idea was, from the beginning, in the Secure Digital Music Initiative, to make bits responsive not to the person in the neighborhood of the bits, but some absent party, a designer whose control over the movement of data had been reinforced by technology. The music industry pursued this goal with a single-minded intensity that nearly destroyed them, because it turned out that they were working for Mr. Jobs and for nobody else in the end. It required the experience of the discovery that controlled technology gave the power to determine who made money from music to the proprietor of the technology rather than the proprietors of the music, to wake the music industry up to the difficulty they had nearly put themselves in. Mr. Jobs was in danger of challenging the control of the four companies in the world that control more than 90% of the world's popular music before they even noticed what was happening to them. They pulled back from the brink in what amounted to a tacit alliance with the very people they have also sued and tried to put in jail. It was only the fact that Mr. Jobs' technology wasn't perfect that rescued the music industry from falling into the open mouth of the Apple company at all. Behind the so-called proprietors of music, there stood the proprietors of cinema, the owners of what we might think of as the worst, largest, loudest video on earth, the stuff where everything blows up, you understand. Their concern for avoiding the difficulties into which the barons of music led themselves has been a remarkable sense of restraint. They have so far restrained themselves from collapsing into the arms of some monopolist of control technology, and they have benefited from the rather poor amount of bandwidth service provided to the people of the world by the barons of bandwidth. File sizes remained large enough that, at least for a while, only the occasional war on a Norwegian child or the attempt to shut down understanding of how DVDs work was necessary to reassure them that the future would remain temporarily profitable. But both industries and their fellow travelers depended for their survival in the form that they had known themselves upon denying the fundamental fact of networked societies. Denying, in effect, what the infrastructure of contemporary society is all about. Networks are for sharing information. That's the purpose for which networks are designed and built and maintained. In order to prohibit the sharing of information in a world of networks, one basically has to attempt to reverse the flow of technological change. And we have lived through one after another serious attempt to revert the flow of technological change. We have seen, year by year, attempts by the dying cultural industries to restore themselves to the saddle, much as though they had attempted to reverse the flow of automobile technology in aid of the horse care population, the stable owners, the saddle makers, the bridle makers, and all the rest. We have, in other words, watched as they adapted themselves to the technology of their own creation by wishing that it would not work quite so well, or quite so fast, or quite so largely, or afford the population quite as much freedom as the technology itself provided. In short, they found themselves in a position familiar to the 19th century political economists who first speculated on the relationship between the bourgeoisie and its own technology. They are suppressing their own power through their own constant drive to free themselves to better functioning. They wanted, in short, to sell air, to make it possible to have the benefit of an indefinitely reproducible inventory without any change in the price level. They wanted to reverse the general crisis of overproduction that was striking them by readjusting property rights in such a way that overproduction could be defined out of existence and the fluidity of their new products reduced to some icy form in which they could handle it and we could not without burning our fingers on the stuff. But of course that isn't the way that it turns out. And so we find ourselves now watching as that last battle shapes itself up. A battle in which, as we all know, the effort is to find some other person or persons who can stand between the failing proprietors of culture and the annoyance, nay, even the hatred, that they raise in the very people to whom they wish to sell their product. Suing your customers, said Michael Dell at the beginning of this, that's not a business model, is it? A fine question, which 8 years after he first asked it has no answer, at least none that Los Angeles can hear. Suing your customers is, of course, a very poor business model. No one in the history of capitalism has ever successfully tried it. And it represents a demonstration of the contempt of the culture industries for their own customers that they would even make the attempt. Microsoft does not sue the Bank of America. The Bank of America does not sue Ford. Ford does not sue General Electric. It is well understood that to sue your customers when your customers are powerful and rich and capable of leverage is a defective idea, defective to the point of self-lethality. The industries which began to attempt to sue their own customers in the interest of the control of culture did so because they thought their customers were weak and foolish. They were children, and they were assumed to be capable of being frightened. Let us put a few children in jail. That will stop everything. Let us charge people for their use of their own culture. That will get them into some state of peacefulness, and they will reorganize themselves as our customers, and they will buy air from us at high prices, and they will go on doing it forever. But of course, this wasn't true at all. What happened instead was that the owners of culture came to find themselves, in general, increasingly irrelevant. Not only because of the actions of the children, that was never the big point. The big point was that the artists could not be pinned in place either. The gravest threat to the music industry at the present moment isn't the listeners, it's Madonna herself. Always shrewd about where the main chance really lies, she and others like her have begun abandoning the recording industry, which no longer has anything to offer them. It wasn't where their money came from in the first place, not even in those fabled second and third and fourth contracts where the money is really supposed to be available to the recording artists. Instead, they have agreed among themselves and with the concert promoters that the future lies in ignoring the recording. recording industry, and they are right. It no longer matters that when I walk down the street I see a Rolling Stone poster that says the future belongs to Radiohead, because by the time it's on the cover of Rolling Stone, it's already obsolete. What has happened, in other words, is that control has slipped away. And only with the utmost coercive power of the state is there any hope that that slippage can be hidden from the shareholders for another minute and a half. This is not actually a game about the restoration of the business. The business is over. This is a game about maintaining the value of stock prices for a little while in the hope that the investors will not desert as rapidly as both the audiences and the producers. Unfortunately, this hope, too, is made to the ear, but broken to the reality. Which isn't to say, of course, that there is no music business. There are many music businesses. Let me offer you an example of one. It is called Magnatune.com, and I would encourage you to take a look at it. We are talking here about a 21st century music recording company. It does not have any studios. It does not have any repertory executives. It has an owner, John Buckland, who sought to begin a new and fairer form of recording distribution system for artists who chose to bring him finished recordings. As you will see, Magnatune.com has now a repertory of approximately 330 artists, including some of the finest performers in the world in almost every genre. Mozart pianists and technical electronic drum and bass artists and folk singers and singer-songwriters and everybody in between, including, of course, all that jazz. Buy the recordings for whatever you wish. Listen as many times as you like through the net without ever buying anything. If you buy a CD for whatever the price is you care to assign to it, you are automatically authorized to share with at least three of your friends. Download in as many formats as you like, and if by any chance you lose the recordings, come back and reauthorize yourself, and without any more payment, download again and share again. Need to license some music for commercial use? Click on the website, and standard license terms are available. And the split with the artist? 50-50. No wonder that the repertoire is growing. No wonder that one of the finest Mozart pianists in the world leaves Deutsche Grammophon to record for Magnatune.com. Well, of course, the recording studio is a property that fits under an arm these days, right? How many are there in this room, recording studios? At least one decent microphone, for which I thank you. And everybody has a recording studio in his pocket. So, it's not the production cost. It's not the enormous risk of lending to these horrible and uncreditworthy musicians all that nonsense from the recording industry over the years. It's simply a merchandising business. And when fairly conducted, there's plenty for the merchandiser and plenty for the creator. There is, of course, little reason even to ask whether this should be regarded as work for hire, though the global music industry refuses to tell you whether regards those artists under contract to it as making work for hire or not. They've tried to have it the best of both ways for the last 40 years. So we have a music business. It is a business in producing tangible copies of music by people acting in their own interests to get the music that they want, where they want it, when they want it, and treating them responsibly and without contempt, they're more than willing to pay. But the very idea of treating the audience without contempt is antithetical to the structure of 20th century media enterprises. Contempt for the audience was the essence of what they did and how they did it. So we find ourselves now wondering about the conjuncture of technology and greed. How it came to be that everything that was solid melted into air? Well, we know, because they wanted to sell the air. How did it happen that the technologies of the 21st century emerged from the maw of the Edisonian technologies of the 20th? Well, digitization was a higher efficiency and better way of generating technology than the analog technology that preceded it. And money moved towards the technology of higher efficiency, even as it began to slide the owner of the money off to the side of the table. Now, of course, the solution is to find somebody else to express contempt for the audience. Who should be the next chosen people to stand in the line of fire between those who want art and those who want money? How about the internet service providers? Let's see if we can push them into the crossfire. And the state, how about the state? Why don't we get them into it too? If they have contempt for the voters, that would be only usual, correct? Well, not so correct. The state has a limit to the extent of its expression of contempt for its voters. Just as in an era of declining telecommunications profitability, the telecommunications operator, too, cannot afford to become too deathly hated. All very well to be contemptuous when you're the only phone company in town, but much more difficult to be contemptuous of the people who do the talking when everybody is a telephone company. And have I mentioned voice over IP? The same thing that happened to music and that is happening to movies is going to happen, is happening, has happened to telephone calls. We share the ability to communicate by voice around the world at low friction and with almost no cost. We buy our bandwidth wholesale and label it out to one another retail at no cost, or nearly no cost. In my law firm, we keep a telephone in the waiting area and in the front, and we allow people to make calls anywhere in the world they want because they cost us nearly nothing. So drop in someday, and even if you don't need a lawyer, maybe you need to call Fiji. It's okay with us. In that environment, the network operators, with their declining profitabilities and their inability to establish a retail business, are going to become the enforcers for the owners of culture. They're going to take all the bullets and live with all the contempt and all the derision and all the desire to go find someone else to deal with because these people are suing their customers. I do not think so. The very idea of banishing people from the net, as I suggested in my opening, is after all contrary to sound social policy, both for those who sell network services and for those who have the fate of societies in their guard. You spend a lot of money making a national information infrastructure only to allow some guy in Los Angeles to tell you to begin exiling your own population because it's good for his business. You know that isn't. The question, in short, is how long the farce will go on before it comes to a conclusion and how much damage will be done in the meantime. And of course, as humanists, we want the farce to end as soon as possible, no matter how funny it may be, because some people will be dangerously hurt. I even have some compassion for the widows and orphans who own the stock. They deserve far better from the people who are managing their money than they're likely to get. The state will also be a major victim. Because it is a poor strategy in the state to render respect for the law a joke. It is a poor strategy for any wise ruler to allow the law to fall into the contempt where it will be put by those who would make use of it for their own narrow purposes in a way which causes it to become a joke or a substance of popular discontent. The sharpest of all weapons against government is always ridicule. And it is ill-advised of any state to make itself ridiculous for that reason. So where we now are, where it really works, is in the trenches of the relationship between people who understand what technology can do for them in their lives and people who do not understand how to make money in the current technological environment. Those behind are pushing very hard. They want allies. They want substitutes. They want people who will stand between them and the firing squad that their own poor behavior has turned civil society into. And they risk seriously the consequences of their own actions. I'm approached almost every week now by a student in my own university or in a nearby university about the bullying behavior of the Recording Industry Association of America. all those millions of dollars I have previously pointed to, collected by extortion from young people, all of them magically, it turns out, not owed to any musician as royalties. Odd, isn't that? Almost 40,000 people, almost $80 million, and not one of them a dollar owing to a musician as a royalty for anything. One wonders why, or perhaps not. The children who approach me are people who have done what? They have taken a file off the net, or it is said, in a society whose Copyright Act makes no provision for communication to the public, that they were offering to communicate to the public some music in their possession. The act is one which one can well understand. It's a knock on the door in the middle of the night. It's a letter of extortion slid under the door. If you don't pay us money, we will hurt you. I was consulted recently by a distinguished visiting professor at a major American university, come on a short academic visit to a country not his or her own, who had brought a child's laptop computer from a city far away because it was the smallest one in the house, and who was then delivered with the compliance of the university a letter demanding $40,000 or else, because the computer had been sharing music, or offering to share music, or considering sharing music without the knowledge of its human owner. But why should that be a problem? You are strictly liable for the technology under your control. If it offers to share with anybody else, that's your problem. Off to the gulag with you. We shall banish you from the net because you weren't a responsible member of the network community. You didn't do as you were supposed to do. You thought networks were for sharing. Obviously, this isn't going to work. Obviously, new models in every direction will arise to nullify this technology, this strategy, this form of law. Obviously, it isn't going to pay. It's an attempt to maintain a Soviet control of populations' understandings in an era of post-Soviet free technology. It's an activity involved in scaring people into the belief that the normal human tendency to share is somehow wrong, criminal, unacceptable. Now, what to do with legislation that purports to put the state on the side of this absurdity? Well, we mustn't be too undignified in our response. It isn't the state's fault that it's been bought. We need to disengage as gently as possible those institutions which belong to us as voters in a democratic society from those institutions which belong to the few who claim to own. We need to say persistently and gently, but without any willingness to go away or change our grasp in the least, that this society is ours, that this network is ours, that we built it. We made its bits, we made its bytes, we put the copper wire and the fiber in the ground, we luxuriated in our control of it, we played with it, we tuned it until it sang. The network is our instrument. It belongs to us the way the streets and the parks belong to us. It belongs to us because it's public, because we made it, because it's here, because we cared for it, gardened it, and grew it up. Leave it alone, we need to say. The good mother state should recognize that it is ours and no one else's. They should recognize that, each of those states, because the alternative is to begin engaging in a slow demoralization of the population's respect for the realities of the rule of law. Because the alternative is to make it appear that the state can be purchased by the music seller or the movie seller, by those who have merely something to peddle and not even something that we necessarily think does the whole of us any particular good. I spent the last 15 years trying to free the executable layer of software in the network. Not myself, of course, just by trying to keep out of trouble and in good working order all those wonderful human minds that went to work reforming the technology, making free software, producing things that were neat, and giving them away. Along the course of that freeing of the software layer in the net, we began to free culture. We began to produce the conditions that would reward the makers of the devices for giving us better devices to use. We created the conditions for those devices. We created the environment in which a digital camera is a useful thing to have in every pocket. We created the conditions under which the things that you can do with a map and a photograph and a song file and a video under production are extraordinary. In my classroom, or a college classroom, or a secondary school classroom in the United States these days, if you say to people, go give us a report about something, most of the time they don't come back anymore with a written document. They come back with a website, with a multimedia production, with a collection of artifacts, of music, and the Wikipedia, and the film we found on the net, and the way we all edited it up, and all the remixing we have done, and all the putting together. We have created a society of creators, and we have given them the material with which to exercise their arts. In compensation, we have reduced the profitability of certain unimportant businesses. And that's a fair trade, if ever there was one. Oh yeah, they will make noise. Of course they will. And they will purchase every politician who is purchasing. They will use every last dollar to strangle every last freedom if it will keep them in business another week. I don't propose that we should criminalize that activity. I don't propose that we should sue these people for being greedy. I don't propose that we should put them in jail or banish them from the network or send them to Siberia. I don't propose that we should use any of these coercive measures against people who are wrong-headed and believe that next Tuesday will be 1855. We should just ignore them. We should just go about our business. We should just not let the law be bent to their will. We should acquit the people who are charged. We should vote out the politicians who do their bidding. We should make it clear to people that contempt for the rule of law is not expressed by sharing. Contempt for the rule of law is expressed by trying to turn the great majesty of the state and the wonder of our technology into a tool for extracting money from people against their will. Can we do it? Yes. Sure we can do it. In fact, we've had 20 years of training while they were busy trying to figure out how to get just a little bit up at the next turn. We've been doing everything we needed to do. We have the software, we have the hardware, we have the bandwidth, and we have the skill, the daring, and the creative knowledge required for the activity. Culture is becoming autonomous of those who owned it in the 20th century. It has almost left the launching pad. It is nearly gone, and at the last minute, they would like us to chain it back up for them, and it's not going to be like that. You're going to have a hell of a fight, you know? They're going to make a lot of noise. They're going to get right up there with the president's visit to the pyramids, you know? It's going to be the biggest thing on page one for as long as they can keep it there. They're going to make it appear that every single person who has anything to say against them is some kind of communist who's crawled out from under the rock that Stalin was buried under. They're going to yell pirate and thief. They're going to carry on like the Dickens. And all of it isn't going to make a bit of difference in the long run because the story's already written. This is a rearguard action. This is the last of the last of the last. And you can prove it. Imagine what it's like to be a child suddenly threatened by a lawsuit. Or for that matter, a distinguished visiting professor in a country far from home. Imagine that knock on the door that says, we, the real people of this society, have a gripe with you. Imagine how frightening it is. I've seen a lot of terrified children in the last 6 years. And I do hold it against the people who terrify them. But no handcuffs. No criminal indictments, no jail sentences. Mr. Murdoch can walk the pathways of his society as free as he pleases, and Mr. Carrie Sherman too. You don't need to fight a revolution against ownership. Ownership is dying at its own good pace. You just need to walk straight forward, keeping your eyes on the prize. You just need to do what you're already doing. Make and share. That's the end of it. Make and share. Because as we create that rich alternative culture distributed in a million alternative ways, we are dooming those who would have us believe that without them there would be silence. Without them there would be no art. Without them, culture would be struck dumb. How does it work? It works because human beings are social animals. They communicate biologically because they must. They interact with one another because there isn't any reality for a human being without an interaction. We are traders of symbolic tokens. We began that millions of years ago, and we are long expert in it. And without the opportunity to exchange tokens of meaning with one another, we shrivel up and we die. It's easy for us to do what we know we're meant to do, and it's hard for anybody to keep us from doing it. That human sociability, that natural tendency to the exchanges of symbolic meaning, tokenized in a sound, a picture, a moving image, all the various ways in which we have learned over generations after generations to make ourselves heard, is the fundamental activity that makes us human. When we speak of the rights of human beings in their environment, when we begin listing the things we think are fundamental, we begin by talking about humans' ability to communicate with one another. And we are very close to one of the great epochs in the history of human beings. The epoch that begins with the ability to connect everybody to everybody else. The epoch that begins when all human minds are capable of interacting without intermediation, one with another, five with five, 1,000 with two, 2 with a million, in every geometry and in every structure of meaning and every form of crying out with love, with grief, with hope, with doubt, with uncertainty, and with religious awe. Human beings are about to come into a communion that has never existed, but which we were always yearning for. We're about to come into the state of complete sociability for which we were made. And we are now facing a few forms of token opposition, ignorance and poverty and greed. And we face them as we have always faced them. The freedom of communication always had enemies. We've been fighting for thousands of years about this. The whole of the modern history of the European nations is the history of the struggle over freedom of thought. Over the question who controls the mind and the destiny of people, ordinary people, in their daily lives. Who controls the ideology of their communication? Who determines what may be shared, with whom, when, and how? We have seen vast sacrifices made for small improvements in the freedom of expression and the right to know. We have seen amazing prices paid by people far stronger and far more determined than we ourselves in order to achieve small victories against the refusal to permit the sharing of knowledge. We have seen enormous crises and great bloodshed over the ability to share our knowledge and our understandings of the world with one another without oppression and control. And after all those centuries of labor, we are close to the end. We're almost there. 6 billion people on Earth, and by the end of this generation, even if there are 12 billion, we could have connected all of them. Ignorance, the deprivation of knowledge, and desperation, the deprivation of culture, are preventable diseases now. We know how, at very low cost, to bring to everybody on Earth the ability to communicate. We can destroy ignorance as the last generation destroyed smallpox. We can eliminate deprivation from everything useful and beautiful because we have nearly finished digitizing everything useful and beautiful. And once digitized, it has zero marginal cost. If one person can possess it, everyone else can possess it at almost the same instant and at almost no additional cost. So in an economy of zero marginal cost, where almost everything that is beautiful or useful can be indefinitely postponed and transferred and copied and reused and remixed, in an environment in which everything that we have ever known has become something that we can teach tomorrow without friction to anybody who wants to learn it, we are not likely to be delayed at the doorstep by the claims of a few people that they will lose money when we are home. We are not likely to be prevented from getting to the end of what we meant to do by people who tell us that they have a business model that doesn't involve everybody's knowing everything they want to know. They have yet to tell us that they are acting in support of ignorance. They have yet to say roundly that their purpose is the permanence of cultural deprivation. They have yet to say clearly that their goal is that you should have only so much art and so much knowledge as you can afford to buy. But soon we will be at grips with them, and they will be forced to declare what is their purpose. We will say, we have built a net which can teach everyone and which can bring all beauty everywhere. Why are you opposed to it? And they will have to say, because we will not be so rich. And then it will be easy to say, well, we feel very bad for you. That's too much of a shame for us even to express. C'est dommage, farewell. This is the moment that is coming. With a little bit of luck, you and I will all live to see it. We don't have to do much to get there. We merely need to be perseverant in the pursuit of the right. We know what the right is. And they will make that lesson ever more clear by doing wrong. They will make that lesson ever more clear by being more thoughtlessly oppressive, by being more unreasonable in their demands, by being more overt in their determination to bend politics to their will. If we are merely quietly persistent, they will make their screaming heard. And people will do what they do when people scream in the street. They'll call the police. So we are watching the working out of the last part of a very happy story. Our friends, the owners, the proprietors of culture, they're not so happy. They're not so sure. You think behind all this bluster there is certainty and confidence? You think that they are jumping up and down with eagerness to put the internet service providers and the state between them and you because they are so capable and so fully conscious of their power? Or because they are afraid, because they doubt, because sunlight no longer serves their purpose? Which is it? Here is how things really work. The culture industries have another 15 years to run, after which time they will either have converted themselves into businesses respectful of the needs of human beings in the 21st century, or they will have been swept aside. Other parties capable of distributing more frictionlessly and with less arrogance will have replaced them. The artists will have moved. Because, of course, the best that they can say is, we stand for the remuneration of the artist. They say it all the time, you hear them, right? Without us, no artist would ever get paid. And others. What compensation is due to an artist when her art has suddenly become visible all around the world to anybody who wants it? Well, nobody compulsorily collected on her behalf. You mean like the collection society? Collecting on her behalf. This is like the people who go from door to door collecting for the charities they never give any money to. Right? If I go out and I start a charity and I collect $80 million from children to pay artists with, and then I don't pay the artists a cent, I'll go to jail. The assumption will be that I'm a thief, a cheater, Oh no, we're merely collection societies. We're merely the Recording Industry Association. We're not criminals, we're doing what we're supposed to do. All right, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I call no man a thief unless he calls me pirate. But it seems to me that the question for whom has the structure of the ownership of culture been good is unlikely to be answered by the statement, oh, the artists made out well. The artists made out poorly, which is why, as they see the new technology offering them alternatives, they begin to desert. And it was that, not theft by audiences, that all of this technological control and legal coercion was designed to prevent. The real goal of the culture industries from the beginning of the digital era was not to prevent the audience from stealing, it was to prevent the artists from finding out that there were better alternatives. Our machinery of alternative distribution was threatening not because it stole from artists, but because it promised better to artists than the existing regime. The merchandiser has been using for the last decade a very weak psychological proposition. You, my dear artist, you, maestro, your enemy is your audience. I alone am your friend. Most musicians are not that stupid. Most painters are not insane. Most sculptors know perfectly well what's what, right? There wasn't an alternative to them. This pseudo-friend, this so-called ally, was the only game in town. And so they played it, and it mostly hurt them, and they mostly died wishing they were rich. I do not think that Mick Jagger has to worry about the love of his audience deserting him. I do not think that even the singer-songwriter down the street in the weakest piano bar in town has more to be afraid of from the people who love his music than from the merchandisers. So what is happening is a realignment of alliances. What is happening is an alliance between those we used to call consumers and those we used to call producers. They are now joined in a network of prosumption. Think about the digital camera for a moment and what it means to be a photographer in the 21st century. To have a digital camera is to be immediately connected to the eyeball of anybody who might like what you are looking at. And we have reduced the friction in the distribution of images from the point of taking to the point of receiving near zero now. Within a year or two or three or four, you are likely to be offered by almost every company with a placard in the airport a digital camera wirelessly connected to the net, which puts your photographs on Flickr the moment you take the picture. Tagged with your location and time, thanks to the GPS chip in the back that you might just as well have done without, and probably giving you some alternative to add a few tags with your thumb after you take your forefinger off the trigger. Should we, in such a world, get all worried about whether photographers are going to be stolen from by viewers? Not at all. The photographers of the world over the last 8 years have largely discovered that free licensing is good for them. The Creative Commons by NDNC license, or the GFDL of the Wikipedia, are licenses which have revolutionized the business of being a professional photographer. Because you get to spread your work through the net to every eyeball that might like to see the picture, but the moment that someone needs your picture for an advertisement, they have to come to you for a commercial license. So by discriminating between the commercial user and the casual viewer, the world's professional photographers have learned that they can have the best of everything. Their photographs can be in every eye, and every commercial user knows where to find them, and they can get paid. The same basic process of using free distribution as a gateway to commercial exploitation of one's own work as an author lies ahead of all the musicians and the videographers as it has come to the photographers. The alternate mechanisms of cultural distribution are up and running. That's why the desperation of the existing owners is so extreme. That's why they have to tilt the pot and push all the chips they have into the game between themselves and the state over who will take the children away to jail in the police wagon. That's why they have to talk about banishing you from the net. That's the net you build. That's the net you run. That's the net you use to make other people's lives better. You have to be banishable from it, because otherwise the alternative mechanisms of distribution will do their business and make yours. So we stand there now. We stand on the cusp of the freedom to communicate, as so many of our forebears have stood before. We stand in a place from which we can see the promised land. We can see the fulfillment of human beings' needs to communicate and share. We can see the end of culture which is proprietized in the interests of the few, which reduces the many to mere consumers. We stand where the technology of the prosumer culture leaves us almost ready to make everything for one another freely. And there are a few last obstacles being put in the way. A few last ugly little barriers we have to jump. A few last unfortunate involvements we have to undertake before we can get over the finish line. I have immense respect for the lawyers and the politicians and the organizers and the dreamers and the lovers and the amateurs who came before us, because I know how hard their work was compared to ours. I know how much they suffered, and I know how much they gave, and I know how little they got, and we are the beneficiaries of their hopes. We happened, lucky generation that we are, to be alive now. And we have a few little cobwebs to sweep away, and we have some blocks beneath our feet to kick beyond if we are to get where everybody has always tried to go. This is the generation in which it happens. It's been a long, long fight, and it hurt a lot of people, but it's almost over. We are the ones who happen to be here, and the difference is, this time, we win. Thank you.
First of all, I want to personally thank you for being here. And as each time I hear you talking or I read you, you give me a bit of hope and make me feel a bit more optimistic about the outcome of all this. Second of all, in the name of everybody participating in La Quadrature du Net, I want you to get sure that we will do our best and even better than that to kick those greedy bastards' ass. We will. And by the way, we need support and help and participation from everybody, but that's another matter. We talked a bit about this already, but I'm afraid, when I'm not as optimistic as when I hear you talking, that the control that once was embedded into the software, that we're beginning to truly emancipate from using free software, is being translated into the network infrastructure. We can see this with many forms of control appearing all around the phone networks, the RFID tags, and so on, that will emerge. Yet there is quite a small community working towards a free network infrastructure. I'm thinking in France of FDN, which is relatively small yet very interesting initiative. What are your insights on this? How do you think we could bridge the communities of freedom for software and freedom for network infrastructure?
So I agree that there are three components to the free society of the 21st century. There's free software, there's free culture, and there's free bandwidth. And without a commitment to establishing freedom in each of those places, there is always the likelihood that control will reassert itself in the layer you leave behind. I would say that these are steps, that there's actually a sequence in them. And I recognize your doubt about that third one. It is high and long, and we have a good deal of work to do in dealing with it. But we have some resources. So let's just take a look at how the sequence unrolls itself. As we freed the executable layer of the network, as we began to make software responsive to its users rather than to anybody else, we created an environment within the network in which there would be an expectation of control at the point where the eyeball and the brain are. We create the possibility of a generation of people who think that stuff should work for them. Left to their own devices, the owners, of course, would extirpate that belief. But they're not left to their own devices. We have their devices. And we use those devices to create an expectation of freedom in children. I said a long time ago that we were merely keeping dinner warm until another generation came home to eat. And that's what the free software movement has been doing. We have been creating an expectation in a generation of people who grew up with the net, that the net is a place that empowers them, not disempowers them. The consequence of that movement of empowerment is the freeing of culture that we are talking about tonight. It becomes the privilege of every citizen of the networked society to speak however she wants. She grows up learning. She can do it. She takes from here, she takes from there, she puts together and she creates something new. The very process of education, that form of experimenting with the world that the American philosopher John Dewey thought of as the structure of education, the nature of the growth of the mind, becomes also an expectation of freedom, an expectation of individuals' rights. That's what Dewey's Democracy and Education said at the beginning of the 20th century. And we are building with our own hands the technology that makes that philosophy reality. So the inevitable consequence of the freeing of the executable layer of the net was pressure on the ownership of culture. And it hasn't taken very long for that pressure to become, as I say, a tidal wave, which is beginning to sweep the landmarks away. Now, of course, they come and they attempt to chain the landmarks to the surface of the earth, but it does no good, you know, the continents move, right? They push them over, that's it, it's done. And so culture begins to free itself, and the next step is to say, well, then we will take the microphone away. We will reassume control over the technology of communication, we'll put everything in there, we'll close that up. There are two things to worry about if you're in that position. One of them is the air around you. Nobody owns that. Every government on earth recognizes that the electromagnetic spectrum is public property, which means property belonging to the people. Every government on earth. Of course, every government on earth also attempts to control it, attempts to own it, license it, permit it, move into it, keep their armies stationed on large parts of it. But no government can any longer ignore the enormous need for what the technical jargon calls unlicensed spectrum. That is, our home yard, right? And we have learned to be more and more intelligent about how we use that home yard, right? We don't worry about interference anymore. We have a zillion intelligent devices that share that unlicensed spectrum, and we'll soon have more. And with that unlicensed spectrum, we begin to prove that the ownership of bandwidth isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Because we begin to show that intelligently used, the part that nobody can deny us will do all the work of all the other parts put together. The very idea of paying for a telephone call will be extinct a generation from now. People will wonder what it meant to pay for a telephone call. There were little boxes on the street that you put coins in order to talk to people? Surely that will be absurd. How could that ever have been? It will strike people funny. Because they will take for granted that everyone can talk to everyone, everywhere, all the time, as long as they want, without even thinking about it. And And that will be true because the electromagnetic spectrum will be working for the people whose spectrum it is. But getting all this impacted power, all this wealth, all this influence, all this relationship to the policemen and the spies and the palaces and all the rest of it, that's the structure of force in the 21st century, right? That's where power really concentrates itself. And you say it's scary, and I agree with you. It's very scary. You say it might win, and I agree with you, it might. When I began to say Microsoft was over, nobody thought it was higher than the truth. Oh, it's crazy. Microsoft isn't over. Look at them, how rich they are. We didn't beat them, they beat themselves. It turned out they couldn't make their product anymore. The cultural warriors, the owners, the possessors of all music and all art and all video, they're in the same situation, right? They can't make as well as we can make, and we don't have to get paid for it. Bandwidth? Yeah, we can produce enough ourselves to begin to put the owners on notice that things are going to change. And as we do, one of the interesting things about what happens to the bandwidth sellers is that they find that the establishment is no longer strong behind them. The VoIP revolution is a case where the fish rots from the head. Your grandmother may not be using voice over IP right now, but SockGen is. It's not necessarily the case that your cousin knows how to make a free phone call to Fiji, but Nokia does. General Motors doesn't pay phone bills anymore, right? They buy their bandwidth wholesale and distribute it to themselves retail, as you and I may do in our personal lives. I couldn't even think straight this afternoon when we were in a meeting this morning because Loic's laptop kept ringing. We've taken all of that and we've regenerated the relationships. You say, they'll fight back. They're pretty scary. They'll put the control inside. We'll have nothing left to do. I've got a potato chip can and a wireless router. And so does my friend halfway across the city, and together we can make music together, right? There's lots of ways that this war over the telecoms is going to go back and forth and back and forth, and there will be good days and bad days, and there will be tactical victories, and there will be strategic defeats, and it's going to be uncertain for the longest time. Say 2025, 2030, but we know how it comes out. We really do. Yes, the current example of the attempt to use the bandwidth provision system to shore up the cultural ownership system is a reminder that they're all going to pull together by the end. But here's something to think about. I spent a little time last year in a small Indian state, the state of Kerala. It's very small, only 57 million people. And it's very poor, the second poorest in India, in fact. Literacy is only 99.5%. I met with the chief minister of the state of Kerala in his study at home in the evening. Little bronze busts of Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh on the mantelpiece, and over his head behind his desk, a vast ceremonial portrait in tapestry of Marx and Engels. But he's a good practical politician, most of whose work is making sure that the streets are clean and that people go to school. They teach free software in the school system. There's no more Windows in Kerala, as of a few weeks ago, in any school. They teach the operation of free software beginning in the first primary grade at 6 years old. And they teach the philosophy of free software, the idea of the sharing of knowledge beginning at age 10. 57 million people. So what happens? 2 decades from now, when those 57 million people have grown up, oh, but they're so poor. Well, yes and no, right? And could we do the same? Well, it's hard, you know. There are lots of countries that I go to and visit, maybe even some you go to or even live in, where if you open a secondary school computer science book, you'll find that what it teaches people is how to use proprietary software. Click here, press this button, drop this menu, do this thing. But it doesn't have to stay like that, right? One of the great problems that we have in dealing with these powerful people who scare you is that our allies out there don't know what they could have. But we can teach them. We can show them. In my office, we built some big glass panes in the hallway by the elevator. We wrote things on the glass by etching them. And one of the things we put there, which I think is really very important, is the following phrase: proof of concept plus running code. Because, of course, that is the mechanism of how we fight the people you're afraid of. Right? We show people not that something could be true, but that it is true. We say to people not, you know, if we had a revolution, we could do it this way. We say to people, we have already done this. It works. Would you like it? Take it. It's free. That's a very strong politics. They won't compete with you at their best. You will say, here, I did this. I like it. You might like it. Take it. It's free. They will say, new introductory offer, 30 euros a month for the first 2 years. And you'll win. Because they can't compete with free. That's the only thing they can't compete with, is free.
Maybe an easy question. Are you telling us that we need to ask our politicians to just wipe out copyrights from the law books?
No. We don't have to ask them to do anything to the law books. The beauty of our position is, if nothing happens, we win. That's why it's always the other guy trying to line up a bunch of law and force it into the books and jam it into your living room. Right? We're doing just fine. We don't need anything. We don't need anything destroyed. We don't need anything built. We don't need a whole bunch more law. We don't need a whole bunch less law. We're okay. History's on our side. It's the other fellow who has the problem, right? And we should be saying that, okay? We don't need anything. Leave us alone. We'll build you a 21st century that will knock your eyes out. We don't need anything. We didn't need venture capital. We didn't need legal subsidization. We didn't need the law books rewritten to give us an edge. We don't need an oligopoly. We don't need relief from competition law. We don't need to fine anybody. We don't need to put anybody in jail. We don't need the courts working overtime. Just sit back and watch, dear President, and we will deliver you a society you will be proud to run. Right? That's the structure of our position. The structure of the other fellow's position is more handcuffs, please. Right? The structure of the other fellow's position is I cannot remunerate the artists unless you make me richer. The structure of the other fellow's pitch is goddamn society, it refuses to behave the way I want. Force it. That's why I like our deal. That's why I think we have the easy hand this time. That's why I think we win. We don't need nothing. And nothing is about what they're willing to give us right now. So let's just strike hands and go our way. Right? We have long expected that the state would have to throw its weight behind us in order for freedom of expression to occur. We long expected that we would have to storm the Winter Palace in order to get oppression, to get its foot off the back of our necks. It's not true anymore. That's not where we are. The beauty of the situation as we find it now is that we need only to ask the state to refuse to make injustice on behalf of the few. And if they take a holiday, we win.
I know it was probably not your intention, but at some point you seem to assume that every form of beauty could be digitized and transmitted, and I do think that it's actually not the case, and quite happily so, let's say. I think I will not even mention it if it was not connected to a kind of resurgence of the importance of what happens in the material world. but is in a network society of the type you described, actually face-to-face meetings, performance, territory, landscape, all these things become not less valuable, but much more valuable. That's why, for instance, there is a potential business for carriers, also because in an information world where everything is rewritten all the time, we need carriers to sort of freeze for our storage or pleasure to hold something, views of that. And so I think it's actually also a way of putting forward the fact that there all these new businesses, they are actually going not just to survive, but they will serve new needs.
So the secret is out now, you see. I come here in order to listen to Philippe and become wise. He does everything that I do, and he speaks better French. Look, this is of course the necessary corrective, right? Edmund stands here and does rhetoric, and Philippe sits there and does diplomacy. It's true, right? The point that he makes is absolutely correct. It isn't that everything becomes digital, it's that everything that people are deprived of that they can't get by immediate personal interaction, they can at least substitute for in some other way. Not better, but at least available, right? We never thought the photograph was better than reality, and allowing for some people's attitudes about sex and travel and so on, you wouldn't rather see the movie than be there, right? Human experience has not become pallid because of the net. It became shareable to some extent, and only to some extent. But the richness of the lives we live in our intimate connection with people are made greater by the availability of all that other stuff that comes into our relationships. All the other people, all the other things, all the other sounds, all the other images. We are making one another smarter this way. And our personal lives and the things that we are privileged to see and do and the people we are privileged to know, we bring more to because of the availability of all that has been experienced before. We have taken for granted all the books and all the photographs and all the music that was in our lives. And we have often reflected on the material deprivation of people around us, but we have rarely even tried to imagine what it was to live in ignorance. I worked when I was a young lawyer for a man in the United States called Thurgood Marshall, who was then a judge of the United States Supreme Court. But he had lived a long and complicated life as a lawyer. He had, I suppose it would be fair to say, invented one kind of being a lawyer in the United States. He had made being a civil rights lawyer possible for a generation of people, and he had won great victories for the equality of people in the face of racism. And there was a story that Marshall told, not to show how great he was or what he had done, but to show something about a moment that had formed him. It had to do with being a young lawyer in Arkansas in the middle 1930s, working on one of the early cases about teacher pay. And he was walking down the street in Little Rock in Arkansas, and there was an 8-year-old boy sitting on a step, and he said, "Mister, mister, what's that? Mister, mister, what's that?" Because Thurgood Marshall was eating an orange, and the boy had never seen an orange. And that was a moment at which I think my boss came to understand that there was something more going on than just the inability of teachers to get equally paid or the fact that black people couldn't use white people's water fountains. Something was being crushed out of the boy that he never even knew the boy was missing because he never even imagined what the condition was. Everybody in this room has a wonderful mind, and everybody in this room has had an opportunity to train that mind, to allow it to expand, to give it knowledge and new experience, and to see what happened. Imagine what it would be like to be unable. not to be able to hear Bach, not to be able to read Thomas Mann, not to know that there are Bach or Thomas Mann in the first place, not to know the history of anywhere, not to know the art of anybody or of anything. So what we are confronting, it is true, is not a world in which everything has been digitized and there's nothing left for us to teach or sing. The tickets are important. The seats that we sell are what sustain us, me and you and everybody else. We live by performances. We live by offering people what is scarce, which is our time, our knowledge, our ability to teach or sing or write poetry. But we don't have to exclude anybody in order to be well. We don't have to do the job of making ignorance in order to have enough to live with. We don't have to impose deprivation. And we don't have to accept anybody else doing it either.
Okay, so if you look on the information as a resource, you're talking about liberating that resource. When you look on other resources also, like electricity or food or etc., can you comment how these ideas of liberating are going in these domains? Can you tell us your observations?
The distinction between the economy of zero marginal cost and the economy of non-zero marginal cost is powerful and deep. Until this generation, the economics that the West knew was the economics of the real economy, where everything has non-zero marginal cost, where every unit of everything must be paid for. And in that world of non-zero marginal cost and rivalrous use, where only one of us can be sitting on the chair or drinking from the particular glass or wearing a particular pair of shoes, the inevitability of scarcity and the necessity of allocating resources and distributing the gains from their manufacture remains a dismal science. And we don't, from the beautiful and complex structure of the digital world, learn how to eliminate that reality. We don't find a way that everybody can wear the same pair of shoes, and we don't eliminate the marginal cost of goods. And so we discover that in the competitive economy, doing well and reaching equilibrium, the price of goods comes to be equal to their marginal cost, just as the economists told us in Ec 101 that it would. And we recognize the limitations and the inevitability of deprivation if we don't find a way to give everybody to according to his needs. What the digital economy does, however, is to allow us to empower people to enter the real economy on favorable terms. It allows us to tell people who are far from the center of human affairs and who have not inherited great opportunities that they too can participate in the real economy because they have a skill, because they have a knowledge, because they have a brain that can be put to work. And so the 21st century economy doesn't lack for features which remind us of the real economy of the past. It doesn't eliminate industrial work, and it doesn't eliminate alienation, and it doesn't eliminate the tragedies of working men's lives. But it gives people opportunities to better themselves that were never there before. Societies that are poor but well-educated have a long history in human affairs. The Scots of the 18th century lived in a poor and benighted land, and yet they give knowledge as teachers and thinkers and writers, philosophers and mathematicians, not just to Europe, but to North America and to much of the rest of the world. In Kerala, they say when a book is written in German, before it is translated into French, it's translated into Malayalam. That is to say, we have always looked out for the new. And we have tried to find a way, by making use of the new, to raise ourselves to the dignity of work. This is an important insight, and one that much of the human race has been prevented from experiencing, because knowledge never reached where they were. What we're going to do that's going to give ourselves a little bit of comfort and an opportunity to share performances of Tosca with one another at low friction is going to have far more consequences for them than they have for us. It won't eliminate the poverty of the real economy. It won't eliminate the injustice of the fact that this table cannot serve those who aren't here to eat on it, and it won't change the fact that I've too much and others have too little. We can't just say, well, now we know how to have anarchism and eliminate property and everything will be fine. I say again, we are not on the verge of changing all the rules and asking government to redo everything and suddenly we live in utopia. The great problem of the European political dream has been the presence of that idea, utopia, nowhere, the place we've all never been, but we know if we could only get there, it would be fine. The beauty of our revolution is its refusal to adopt utopianism. We're not talking about nowhere. We're talking about proof of concept and running code. Conservative approaches to pragmatic issues, real problems getting solved in real ways. Everybody here knows what the problems are that can be solved, and everybody knows a little bit about the solutions. No magic. Nothing behind the curtain. No smoke, no mirrors, no coup de foudre, no lightning. Just good code that runs, and we could make it better if we took another night and really just pushed on through.
It's difficult to have freedom of speech, freedom of movement. It's difficult to be free when you don't have privacy. And in the project of law, Création Internet, one of the main findings is to oblige?
Fourth.
Thank you. To force people to monitor what is done with their computer. Everybody in France will have to be its own big brother and to monitor what is done by our lover, our friend, our children. How do you see this surveillance society growing and this fight between freedom and privacy?
Well, it was nice to be here. Thanks very much. This will take a long time, so I'm not even going to start. I'm only going to indicate the direction of the start. Free software is about freedom. Mm-hmm. As Stallman was right. You understand? The movement to free the technology is the only guarantor we have of not being ultimately controlled by the technology. And you're right. What's happening now in the technological environment in which we live is a strengthening of the claim to be more aware of us than we ever have been before. The search engine knows what we wish and dream of and would like to have. The search engine plus the owner of the credit card plus the guy in possession of the supermarket tape plus the guy who knows where the car was driven plus the little man taking pictures of every license plate in the UK once every 24 hours. Together they have a kind of power incipiently over us that no totalitarian state in the 20th century possessed. I don't know how many of you saw Florian von Danziger's wonderful movie, The Lives of Others. But if you have, you know the extraordinary pathos of the files of the regime that was the German Democratic Republic after it's all over. And you realize how many thousands and thousands and thousands of people spend hundreds of thousands of hours spying on everybody else and writing it all down in little pieces of paper which sat in books, in filing rooms, in room after room after room. But of course nobody could get to it all or know what it all meant. Not true now. Data mining, that is to say, the getting of the data about us to answer questions about us that nobody even thought to ask yet, is the great problem behind all this spying you are talking about. It isn't merely that there is more data collected, it's that the data is active in a way that the data of secret policemen never was before. It anticipates you. Models built on what you have done are being constructed to predict what you will do next. Most of that information is there for a simple reason. Somebody wants to sell you something and they'd like to know how. In the United States, if you get a new cellular telephone this year, it has to have GPS in it. The stated reason why your phone has to report its location all the time is that if you call the emergency services, they have to know where to come with the ambulance. But the real beneficiary of GPS in the telephone will be Kentucky Fried Chicken. The real actual benefit of all that location information is that people are trying to study where you are at 3:30 in the afternoon when you suddenly get hungry. And they want to be able to SMS your phone. You know, there's a special at KFC on just what you like, and it's only 50 meters that way. One more sale is a pretty good deal. Disneyland? Do I need to tell you about Disneyland? It's a place, you know. Actually, it's a number of places, one of them near here. You have to go there. You have to go there. You have to go there several times in a lifetime. If you are taken to Disneyland as a child, the Disney company opens a file on you. And it buys everything that can be bought about you for the rest of your life. It studies all of that information in order to figure out how to get you to go back. Of course, you will go back. The assumption is you'll go back twice more in life, once with your children and once with your grandchildren. But if the Walt Disney Company can convert 3 trips in a lifetime at Disneyland to 4 trips in a lifetime, Euro Disney can continue to exist. If not, it will go broke. So Disney will spend a lot of time analyzing you to figure out when would be a good moment to get you back for that 4th in a lifetime visit. And it is well worth it to buy all the data about everybody who's ever been there and keep processing it until some model shows that it's the right moment to send you another ad. Scared? Of course it's bad. And we are in trouble about it. We're in trouble because we have made a number of judgments about technology collectively that are wrong. We have bought for free web hosting and a low-quality CMS from something called Facebook, or maybe it was MySpace. We've decided that the World Wide Web is too complicated to deal with. We don't know how to set up websites and RSS feeds and all this. Who knows what, how to do all that? Let's just go to Facebook. The result is that they have the log. And the log is the great information gold mine of the 21st century. Right? So you're quite right. These are big problems. They're big problems. They raise enormous difficulties. I'm starting this summer to try and write a book about the difficulties that they raise. It's not whether you go to Disney. It's whether you go to the polls on election day. Imagine if you know everything that there is to know about the voters in a small or moderate-sized democracy. Imagine what it would take to find a way to get 1% of them to decide they have something more important to do on any given Sunday than to vote. Modern electoral democracy is about driving 1% or 2% of the voters either towards or away from the polls, and away is usually the better bet. What does it mean in a society like mine, which uses juries to determine who goes to jail, if somebody in the prosecutor's office has a predictive model of everybody who's been called for jury duty? What does it mean when the state can buy on the open market information sufficient to predict the behavior of citizens? We haven't even begun to consider the full social problems that are raised by the end of forgetting, and by the nature of what can be done after forgetting is obsolete. So I'm not going to disagree with you in the least about this. This is another whole problem with a lot of work to be done. But note that the tools of our liberation are the software we are making together. Note that the question is, how does a web server work? How does an appliance work? Could I maybe deal with this by getting together a bunch of good hackers and saying, you know what we need to do? We need to produce an appliance you can go and buy in the store. And you take it home and you plug it into the wall and into the power mains, and it's your Facebook. It's your presence on the net. It conducts your friendships and it updates your profile and it serves all the good information about you, but it keeps its logs in the little back where you can press the button and vaporize them once a week. Right? In other words, we need to have privacy-safe technology, and we're the boys to build it. We need to do it And we need to give it away to people, and we need to show them why they want to use it. And once again, we can count on the other fellow to do the advertising for us. So I agree with you entirely. This is the great second frontier in what the free software revolution has to do. And it's why open source is not really a good definition of what we're about. Because this is the moment when we really get to say free, as in freedom. Mm-hmm. Freedom from inspection, freedom from surveillance, freedom from calculation, and therefore freedom from control. And guys who have spent a lot of time figuring out how a preemptive queuing system ought to work, or how a really good cluster file system ought to work, should now be turning their attention to a simpler question like, how do I keep the other guy from getting the log? Right? But we're going to attend to these questions. I don't have any doubt that we're going to attend to them, because you're afraid, and he's afraid, and she's afraid, and we're all hackers, and we'll all do something about it. We're going to build safer technology, and we're going to explain to people why they don't want to live in a privacy fire trap, and it's going to work. Thank you.